Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, January 21st, 2024. My name is Bill McCann. And I'm going to finish the story I started last week. Why are American drivers so deadly? After decades of declining fatality rates, dangerous driving has surged again. The problem today in the United States may be that we're all baseline angry and anxious, and we're all in a car all the time, or what feels like it anyway, outside the few fully walkable cities or the ones with reliable public transportation. Most communities require a car to traverse, and traverse slowly. Traffic is up across the country, as is the duration of our average one-way commutes, which recently topped 27 minutes, the longest in our history. When Heather Padilla, professor at the University of Georgia and the director of the school's Traffic Safety Research and Evaluation Group, decided to start a pilot study of driving habits in rural parts of her state, she discovered that a vast majority of respondents drove everywhere they went, work, the supermarket, and drove there fast. Relative to other risky behaviors, there was a more accepting attitude towards speeding, more reports of frequent engagement with it, Padilla told me. Residents felt as if they knew the roads well and were comfortable on them. It wasn't uncommon, she added, for people to say they sometimes looked down and realized they were going much faster than they'd thought. If you have the stomach for it, possibly the clearest window into the changing mindset of the American driver can be found online on message boards like Reddit, where posters are free to unburden themselves anonymously, or more commonly, to vent about others. The most persistent theme may be the story of the instigator, a mild-mannered driver forced into action by the conduct of his or her peers. In a Reddit post from October, a driver recounts the experience of being prevented from merging into traffic by another vehicle. "I'm not proud of it," the poster recalls. "I got angry. A cycle of retaliation followed. At one point, the action spilled into the breakdown lane. I flipped her off, as she did to me," poster writes, noting that he came close to clipping her. As he drove off, he realized he became the expletive as well. Other Reddit threads are devoted to electronic distraction, a behavior that organizations like the NHTSA have recently tried to curb with a multi-million-dollar wave of public awareness campaigns. 2007, Washington became the first state to ban texting while driving. As of late 2023, 49 states have adopted similar laws, and 34 states allow the police to pull over drivers for using a handheld phone behind the wheel. Whether the legislation will prove efficacious in the long term is yet to be determined. For the time being, the trends are stubbornly ascendant. More than 32,000 Americans were killed in wrecks caused by distracted driving between 2012 and 2021, with a roughly 11% increase in the number of deaths from 2020 to 2021. You don't even need to physically see them texting. You can tell most of the time by them not keeping a constant speed and veering lane to lane, one Redditor recently observed. "Almost every time I see someone driving like that, I think, this idiot is playing with their phone, and most of the time I'm right. It's almost like watching a drunk go down the road." Although the poster may not have realized it, the connection is probably true. Studies show that distracted driving increases crash risk as surely as vodka, and the disorientation seems to be enduring. Last year, a team of scientists led by David Strayer of the University of Utah had a group of volunteers climb into a driving simulator and perform a battery of multitasks: check the phone, turn to talk to a passenger. Predictably, Their ability to concentrate on driving declined considerably as the tasks were performed. But for many participants, the inability to focus continued for up to 30 seconds after a task was complete. The research is ominous for the obvious reasons and the less obvious. In calculating which wrecks are attributable to texting while driving, the NHTSA focuses on messages sent immediately proximate to a collision. Strayer's research seems to suggest that the window should be widened and that more crashes may be a result of distracted driving than current data indicates. Under increased government pressure, the audio industry has rolled out technology that can nudge us away from using our phones. Multiple car manufacturers, for example, have placed sensors on some of its cars that are capable of detecting when a driver's eyes wander from the road and of issuing a warning via a dash display. But such features are overridable and are available mostly as expensive add-ons to already expensive vehicles. Brian Moody, executive editor of the website Auto Trader, told me he expected more manufacturers to adopt automated safety technology in the coming years, at lower prices and across more types of vehicles. However, he went on, these are businesses we're talking about, and they're in business to make money. They don't want to be sued, and I'm not so cynical to think they don't care about deaths. They care, but at the risk of being crass, cost is a consideration. A young driver in the market for a $40,000 vehicle can find one with a suite of so-called nanny features, or one with a massive engine and asphalt stripping torque, but probably not one with both. And young drivers, as has long been the case, tend to account for a lot of the exceedingly dangerous behavior on American roads. 2012, 4,283 drivers aged 15 to 20 were involved in fatal crashes. In 2021, the last year for which there is data, it was 5,565. As is the case with other demographic groups, more teenagers are speeding. Of all driver age brackets, young males are the most likely to be traveling above the posted speed limit at the time of the fatal crash. The purest expression of the teenage speeding phenomenon is the rise in illegal street racing. I think of it as a plant or a weed that hasn't been taken care of, and during the pandemic, the thing just grew wild, says Lily Trujillo Puckett, who founded Street Racing Kills in 2014 after Puckett's 16-year-old daughter was killed during a street racing event. Puckett now works with courts in California, Florida, and Texas on intervention programs for offenders. When you meet these guys, they tend to tell you the same thing. She says, yeah, they know it's dangerous. They know they can get hurt and that they can hurt others. But they love the adrenaline rush. They love the excitement. And they have that quality of an immature mind. They say, it's not going to happen to me. National data on crashes resulting from street racing is hard to find, but officials in California, Florida, and Texas, where the phenomenon is endemic, have reported significant increases in the number of complaints. 2021, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department received 1,380 calls from residents about local races, up 60% from the previous year. Amanda Granite, a spokeswoman for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Florida, told me that most of the racers the country's deputies have apprehended were young and male. But not all of them, she clarified. We have also arrested female drivers, including a mom in a minivan, for doing donuts in the roadway. In September, the Department of Transportation posted early 2023 data showing that 21 states had recorded climbing rates of fatal crashes compared with the same period in 2022. 29 had experienced modest improvement. I can't claim that we have it all figured out because it could change, says Colonel Matt Langer, head of the State Patrol in Minnesota, where officials recorded 11% year-over-year drop in fatalities. But that drop, Langer says, represents several dozen people alive now who would have been dead a year ago. And what has made that possible is a focus on the behaviors that are killing people. So speed, seatbelts, impairment, and distraction. For us, a full 85% of our enforcement work last year was on those four things. In 2022, Langer says, his officers spent more time monitoring fast roads and busy intersections and dedicated more enforcement resources to heavy traffic days, like the start of the state's fishing season, which has been described as a high holy day for Minnesotans. Anything that increases the certainty of getting caught is going to make a dramatic difference, he told me. If I know I'm going to die from lung cancer, I'm less likely to smoke those cigarettes. It's the same thing here. Langer is not wrong about the efficacy of stronger enforcement. A country like France is proof. In 2003, the French government began installing a network of speed cameras on its roads and ratcheted up fines. As a result, rates of speeding steadily dropped in the first decade of implementation, as did the number of severe injuries and fatalities. And many provinces in Canada more or less revoke the license of impaired drivers, often impounding the driver's vehicle for good measure. Years ago, my wife and I took a trip to Australia and rented a car to drive from Melbourne to Sydney. I remember flying down the undulating highway, marveling at the tortoise-like pace of the cars around us. Then I got home, opened my mail, and discovered a $400 ticket passed on to me by the rental car company. Attached was a picture of me behind the wheel, oblivious to the reality that the other drivers had already internalized. The highway was studded with speed cameras. I think there's a day coming where we're going to have to embrace technology more than we have now, Langer said of the United States, because the safety benefits are there. The reduced roadside interactions, the flow of traffic, all of it gets better, including the road becomes safer. The issue, he went on, is that many Americans are pretty averse to that type of technology right now. On the left, automated reinforcement tends to be condemned for disproportionately affecting communities of color and trapping residents in debilitating cycles of court debt. On the right, critics are apt to bristle at any scheme that could be construed as trespassing on a person's civil liberties. Deborah Coles told me she remembers asking about data from speed cameras that had been installed in Las Vegas. I got a response saying that Nevada had passed legislation forbidding the use of the cameras in that way, she said. Coles, having lived in Nevada for decades, recognized the politics behind the decision. A lot of people, a lot of politicians, consider us to be a frontier state, with all the liberty that implies, she said. As of 2023, 18 states and the District of Columbia have legalized speed cameras, and 22 states and D.C. have legalized red light cameras. But 8 states have taken measures to outlaw both. In a representative sample in 2013, 2 St. Louis drivers contested red light cameras-related citations, claiming that someone else was behind the wheel of their vehicles at the time of the infractions. Their challenge reached the Missouri Supreme Court, which ruled those citations unconstitutional because they shifted the burden of proving the identity of the driver onto the drivers themselves. For years, nearly every speed and red light camera in Missouri would be turned off. Last January, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg delivered a keynote address at the annual Conference of American Mayors in Washington. The topic was car wrecks. Somehow this issue gets dramatically less attention than many of the other transportation issues we face, he said. Many of you, for example, are rightly focused on confronting the scourge of gun violence. I want to remind you that the loss of life in traffic crashes in our communities is almost identical in its proportions. Not long after his appearance at the mayor's conference, Buttigieg announced the first recipients of the Safe Streets and Roads for All grant program, which will, over the next 5 years, issue more than $5 billion to cities and municipalities with documented road safety issues. When we spoke recently at his office near the Navy Yard, he gestured across the street at a construction site. A good systems design has to account for people making mistakes and prevent those mistakes from being lethal, he said. That's how anything from the way that guy's tied off on the construction project to the guardrails you have in our aviation system. Of course, behavior matters, he added. But you need to surround the work we're trying to do on behavior with designed things that neither compensate for behavior or, just as importantly, nudge that behavior in the right direction. Because sometimes being beaten over the head by an ad campaign will have less of an effect on your willingness to drive a safe speed than narrowing the lane by a foot so that it just doesn't feel like the road itself is inviting you to hit the gas. Of the $5 billion earmarked for the grant program, about $1.7 billion has already been distributed. The grantee list comprises metropolitan areas, Detroit, Queens, and small rural municipalities like Fayette County, Iowa, where 60% of recent road fatalities and serious injuries have been linked to lane departure crashes, trucks and cars shooting off the road at egregious speeds. Fayette County officials will use the grant to widen the shoulder on miles of highway and add rumble strips to alert drivers when they've reached the periphery of the asphalt. Engineering 101. The scope of the solution should match the scope of the issue. Rumble strips represent a major step forward for the folks in Fayette, but they would be insufficient for drivers in Hillsborough County, Florida, a municipality that has one of the highest annual traffic fatality rates of all large American counties, 67.6 deaths per 100,000 residents. Because pedestrian and cyclist deaths there have also outstripped the national average, a significant portion of the $21.5 million awarded to Hillsborough will go to the creation of protected sidewalks and bike lanes. The remainder will be routed to what's known as speed management. More stoplights, more speed bumps. If you're in a rush, you may explosively curse the sudden appearance of a roundabout, but you'll almost certainly slow down anyway. Calm the traffic, choke the traffic, divert the traffic, or enact a road diet, which is exactly what it sounds like. Louisville, has pledged to use its own $21 million in federal money to reduce the number of traffic lanes on 12 busy thoroughfares around the city and reallocate space for refuge islands, bicycle lanes, on-street parking, and transit stops, a model that has been proved to have an ameliorative effect on fatalities in the United States and abroad. I remember as mayor of South Bend traveling with a delegation that was looking at good pedestrian and cyclist infrastructure around Europe, Buttigieg told me. And the most striking thing to me was really the story of how each city got there. If you look at the pictures of, let's say, Copenhagen in the 70s, you realize very quickly that today's bicycle culture there is not the result of some immutable Nordic affinity for bicycles, he continued. It's the result of decisions that they made over the years, because if you look at those older pictures, you see a place that is as unfriendly to bicycles as many American neighborhoods would be today. Buttigieg has cause to be optimistic that those decisions could be replicated here, in contrast to, say, stricter gun laws, road safety initiatives, or less likely to be seen by politicians and their constituents as a partisan issue. By changing a culture takes time. In 2015, Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington backed a Vision Zero plan to eliminate traffic deaths in the city by 2024, largely via better pedestrian and cyclist access and the type of road dieting Louisville has proposed. 6 years later, in 2021, the Capitol recorded 40 roadway deaths, a 14-year high. A subsequent report by the D.C. auditor found that implementation of the plan had been delayed and mismanaged, and it criticized a lack of leadership and follow-through at the city level. And even in cities held up as exemplars of the Vision Zero model, patience can be required. New York, which has committed more than $1 billion to build safer streets, recently recorded the fewest pedestrian fatalities in more than a century. But cyclist deaths simultaneously surged to some of the highest levels in decades. In general, as with many types of civic improvement, things can get worse before they get better. Cities and the commuters living in them have to learn to adapt to a new pattern of life. The prevailing understanding seems to be that when you introduce more people on bikes and on foot, you have more risk of collision, Buttigieg said, recalling the evolution of a city like Copenhagen. But then, over time, motorists become more aware, the infrastructure and support gets built, and the streets get safer. He paused. I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think there's some cosmic reason, as with gun violence, why Americans should be doomed to worse outcomes than Europeans. But we do have to act. Every year, for the past decade and a half, the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety has published something called the Traffic Safety Culture Index, a kind of state of the union of American roads. I had thought the 2022 edition was bleak. The headline from AAA's news release, "Going in Reverse, Dangerous Driving Behaviors Rise." But the 2023 report was equally grim. Of the 2,500 licensed drivers who responded to the AAA survey, 22% admitted to switching lanes at high speeds or tailgating. 24% admitted to running a red light. 40% admitted to holding an active phone while driving. And 50% admitted to exceeding posted speed limits by 15 miles per hour or more, all within the last calendar month. Worse, a sizable number of respondents say they knew that people important to them would somewhat or some completely disapprove of that behavior. They did it anyway, despite the risk of opprobrium and despite the fact that, as the AAA dryly noted in an accompanying news release, a motorist's need for speed consistently fails to deliver shorter travel times. It would take driving 100 miles at 80 miles per hour instead of 75 miles per hour to save just 5 minutes on a trip. This last point is worth dwelling on, not only because it feels logical, but because this logic can feel rapidly irrelevant once we are behind the wheel. Driving is like this, to paraphrase Ryan Martin, the psychologist and anger specialist. It is the ultimate evoker of base emotions. We may be zipping down the highway, trapped on our own steel bubbles, but we're influenced by the behavior of the residents of the bubbles next to ours. Imagine a time when someone has been aggressive to you, says Amanda Stevens, the Monash researcher. How does that make you feel? She continues, most often people will brush it off and say, don't worry about her, I'm not going to get involved. But if you're running late or have a stressful meeting to attend and someone is rude to you then, you might react with aggression or anger directed at them or at the next driver who does something. That next driver might also react in some way, perhaps becoming anxious and changing their driving. Bad behavior tends to be contagious. The more of it we come in regular contact with, the more likely we are to drive badly ourselves, and the more likely we are to accept bad driving as the status quo. Not long ago, I had an Uber take me from my home in Atlanta to the other side of town. The driver, a young woman, wove relentlessly in and out of the late morning traffic. At one point, confronted by a UPS truck signaling for a left turn, she steered two wheels of her Kia onto the curb. When I politely suggested I would have been okay waiting for the truck's turn to be complete, She looked back at me in genuine confusion. "What do you mean?" she asked, both eyebrows raised. That was just how she drove. It was just how everyone drove. The author, Matt Shaer, is a contributing writer for the magazine, an Emerson Collective Fellow at New America, and a founder of the podcast studio Campside Media. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. Stop ignoring all the mundane miracles in your life. Turn your monotonous moments into monuments by taking notes of what you observe. It only takes 15 minutes a day. It's a story by Anna Cody. After a long day at work, I absent-mindedly boarded an express train. What should have been an 18-minute commute home turned into a 50-minute journey from Manhattan to Brooklyn and back. Sitting on that last train to my apartment, I felt a digital dreariness overcome me. I'd spent all day responding to emails, Slacks, and DMs. I just wanted to not look at a screen. I didn't have a book with me, so I took out my notebook and jotted down everything I saw, heard, or smelled. A backpack occupying a seat for a human. A woman wearing a spiky hat. Shoelaces untied. Shoelaces tied. An aggressively yellow ad for something called Multivad. Do not lean on door. Snoring. The person next to me typing out a text. Dinner next week before quickly deleting it and locking his phone. I don't have any Seine River like Monet. I've just got U.S. 66 between Oklahoma and Los Angeles, the painter Ed Ruschka once said. Ruschka, who painted gas stations, apartment buildings, and the 20th Century Fox logo, among other iconic images of post-war American life, turned the monotonous into monuments. New York, filled with wonder and excitement, is also ridden with sights that ubiquity has made boring. Ads for bags most of us can't afford, hordes of people wearing the same faux leather jacket and high-waisted jeans they saw an influencer wear on Instagram, and trash, lots of trash. I thought that paying attention to these ostensibly negligible aspects of the world, as Ruschka did, would open something up, help me better understand our present, or be more okay with the fact that much of our life is filled with mundanity. Since that train ride, I've made a habit of observation journaling, recording everything my eye notices, including the people, sounds, smells, noises, and screens. Sometimes I go out with the sole purpose of logging my surroundings, setting a timer for 15 minutes while sitting at a coffee shop, bar, or other public accommodation. When I find myself impatiently waiting for something with nothing better to do, I start writing things down, taking note of everything there is to possibly take note of until my food or train station or whatever it is invariably arrives. By now, I've filled almost an entire notebook with these perusals. Some places offer the same sights ad nauseum. You'll almost always see a bored dad or boyfriend with glazed over eyes at the waiting area in the Glossier store in Soho, a National Geographic magazine from the early 2010s in a doctor's office waiting room, or a forgotten but well-loved stuffed animal lying on the ground in the park. Encountering these scenes over and over, I started to think more deeply about the sights we've taken for granted, the things that slip the attention of social media's endless cataloging. These details came to feel like the intimations of the lives that people live around us. Who was the child who left that stuffed animal there? Are they mourning it, or have they forgotten all about it? I didn't invent this practice. In the book, An Attempt at Exhausting a Place in Paris, the French filmmaker and writer Georges Perec chronicles everything unimportant that he observed over the course of 3 days on Place Saint-Sulpice in Paris. In his introduction, Perec writes that much of the built environment there, including the church, fountain, police station, have already been described, inventoried, photographed, talked about, or registered. His intention, rather, is to describe that which is generally not taken note of, that which is not noticed, that which has no importance. What happens when nothing happens other than the weather, people, cars, and clouds? These transitory items and people might say more about our time than cathedrals or statues. They are what's particular to our era and thus reflective of its ailments and ethos. On that commute, for example, there was a point where the train hurtled above ground and people craned their necks to take in the skyscrapers. Impressive, I admit, but I was more interested in the text that a fellow passenger repeatedly typed out and deleted. Fascinated that a person could carefully compose a message to send to someone and then take it back, the only record of it being my observation. One day when my partner and I were eating sponge cake at a Chinatown bakery, we journaled and compared notes. It was one of those days on which we simply had nothing to say to each other. We lived together and we'd spent most of the week working from home together, cooking dinner together, and watching the same movies together. We scribbled, then swapped pages, seeing the world from each other's eyes. How did he not notice the curly-haired couple arguing about whether they should invest in fancy silverware? How did I not notice the gooey red substance oozing from the floorboards? There are many plausible answers to the question of what people did before smartphones. Perhaps people carried print newspapers around. Maybe it was more common to talk to the stranger sitting next to you. But certainly people had to take in their surroundings more. Phones with their ability to transport you to other worlds want to convince you that the one you're stuck in doesn't have anything worth paying attention to. But through my journaling, I realized something. We're shoulder to shoulder with many universes, countless lives, hopes, dreams, and fears, as complicated as our own, all clustered in the same crowded shops, train cars, and sidewalks. Why ignore all that? Anna Cody writes about design and culture for the real estate section of the Times. I'm going to read another letter of recommendation. Tired of meditation? Try looking for clams. For those of us who have difficulty finding peace while sitting in one place, clamming can be an unexpected escape. There's a beautiful picture under the headline. Oranges and greens, and bright sun, and it shows two kids in front of the mother walking along with some clamming equipment, I assume. This is a story by Kim Gooden. On these dark winter evenings, when the end of the day has crept up all too quickly and both of my children are speaking to me at once while I'm trying to follow a recipe and my laptop is still open with incomplete work, I find myself daydreaming of summer. I think of the one activity in place that quiets my mind and restores my drained reserves. Clamming on Cape Cod, which is foraging for clams, from large quahogs that can be baked or used for chowder to my favorite, smaller ones, the so-called little neck clams that you eat raw that same day at cocktail hour. There's a spot on the southern side of the peninsula that is empty and natural and peaceful. It requires a car that can handle dirt roads with potholes the size of sea turtles and a thick skin for racing the last stretch on foot through a mosquito-infested forest. But if you make it that far, you're rewarded with a tranquil bay ringed by a thin stretch of sand that quickly disappears into tall grasses. The water is always the perfect temperature and remains waist-deep as far as I've ever walked into it. Before I had kids, it was a novel thing to do, a much-needed act of outing after days of vacation-level eating and drinking. But when I went with toddlers, the experience took a turn from diversion to devotion. The bay became part of the world I was trying to build for my children, one that is beautiful and, if treated properly, can provide for you. The act of clamming became an unexpected escape, a moment when I wasn't thinking about 20 disparate things, when I wasn't really thinking at all. The routine is the same. We set the children up on the little beach where they can make sand castles or search for fiddler crabs. Armed with a clam rake, a long wooden pole attached to a metal basket that is edged with sharp tines so you can scrape and scoop, we wade out into the water until we each find a spot that feels lucky. Typical of New England, you can't see an inch below the surface of the water. So to clam, you gently scrape the rake across the ocean floor, feeling through the pole, listening with your hands to see what's down there. You learn that a tug is just a clump of seaweed. A clang is a rock. A panicked clamor is God knows what and best to move along. But if your palms can detect a gentle zip, like running a fingernail over corduroy, then you might be scraping the corrugations of a clamshell. If you can feel the tines tap something hard but not too solid and entrenched but not too stuck, you may have a clam. So you dig, scoop, and lift. Out of the water rises your rake, and if you listened well, you will have a clam sitting in it. You deposit your treasure in a metal basket that sits in an inner tube and floats beside you, connected to your wrist by a cord. To clam properly, you have to relinquish your thoughts and expectations and preconceptions, even those of how your senses work. You have to become one with the rake. You have to have eyes and ears on the ocean floor. It's akin, perhaps, to what some get out of meditation. I'm an aspiring meditator, but as someone who, before a torn meniscus, always used running as a stress relief, I have a long road ahead of me before I can find peace sitting in one place. With clamming, I feel that I come close. Maybe I would be better at meditating if it promised a martini and raw bar at its conclusion. This year, for the first time, my children wanted to join in the clamming. I was worried that it would take some of the peacefulness away, which it did, but I was happy for them to give it a try. My daughter delivered a stream of consciousness narrative of what we were doing, and I kept yelping when my son almost raked my feet. But there was joy in having something to teach them, to share with them, to connect them not only to a generational tradition, but also to the history of the island, where the Mashpee Wampanoag used to harvest from these same waters, and still do. There was a disruption to our usual dynamics as we embarked on a treasure hunt together, communing as much with one another as with nature. But when they raised their basket and it wasn't a rock for the 100th time, but rather a shining little neck, it was a richer moment than if they had struck gold. Seeing a child with ocean water gleaming off his perfect skin, holding up a mollusk with an expression of success on his face, does more for the heart than any meditation ever could. I hope that one day my children will view clamming as the respite that I do. They're not there yet. At this point, it's more adventure than retreat. At the end of our clamming morning, when we had gathered our quota, my 6-year-old refused to leave, insisting she needed one more clam. We leaned against our rakes and waited. In her final act, full of defiance, she slammed the rake down into the shallow water, and when she lifted it back up into the air, we saw that she had stabbed a clam between the halves of its shell with the tine of the rake. She beamed with pride. To be fair, perhaps what she needed to get from clamming was not what I needed. Perhaps what she needed was to have a tiny bit of control over this wild world, one in which she has little say. In that moment, she was victorious, if not calm, then in clam. Kim Gooden publishes The Creators Forum, a Substack that explores motherhood and creativity. She is the former managing editor and copy chief of the California Sunday Magazine. She lives in Beacon, New York. I'll read a Screenland. TikTok invaded this cruise for content. Maybe someday it'll come for you. Even if you didn't sign up for the reality TV treatment, your life may be mined for drama and packaged for consumption by influencers. This is a story by Zachary Siegel. People on this cruise ship continue to give me dirty looks everywhere I go, Mark Sebastian announces to his 1.5 million followers on TikTok. He's filming in a cabin on board the ship, addressing the camera in classic reality TV confessional style. Text floats above his head. It reads, "Day one on the 9-month cruise." The ship in question is Royal Caribbean's Serenade of the Seas, now on a 274-night ultimate world cruise, set to visit 65 countries in every continent, including Antarctica. It took to the seas on December 10th, carrying its presumably well-heeled passengers. The full cruise cost almost as much as a year's tuition at an Ivy League institution. Sebastian is not precisely one of them. His day one came later. He's there because the cruise has become a strange online obsession. It began with passengers posting snippets of their experience on TikTok and spiraled rapidly from there. The Serenade of the Seas morphed into a spontaneous mashup of HBO's The White Lotus and Bravo's Below Deck. Viewers back on land started gobbling up every morsel of cruise-related content they could find, producing their own commentary, concocting their own wild storylines, turning passengers into characters. Many observers are now openly rooting for this opulent vacation to devolve into some kind of entertaining chaos, seizing on any sign of trouble, real or imagined, as a potential first act. Flooded rooms, a storage of preferred wines, rumors of sexual libertines, illness, exclusive perks for so-called Pinnacle Club members, maybe. Somehow, sparking class conflict. And of course, microaggressions. This is the drama in TikTok parlance, the tea supposedly captured on board. Sebastian was initially one of those gawking non-passengers, but he used his own online following to TikTok his way on board for one leg of the trip, paid for by Atria Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. There's going to be mutiny. There's going to be blood. Someone is going overboard. I want to watch, he told his followers. Put me on the cruise. I'll go. I will cause chaos. I will wreak havoc. And I will record everything. These are the obvious reasons fellow cruisers might be giving him dirty looks. In his cabin confessional, he inserts a shot of himself walking around the ship, smacking gum, as a perturbed fellow guest can be overheard saying, "He's videotaping everything." Sounds like a warning. Stay away from the camera. The audience on land clearly has a fantasy of what cameras may catch. Something juicy, like a disgruntled crew member struggling to serve an impossibly demanding guest. If you stare long enough, connect the right dots, perhaps you'll glimpse some tense dynamic, the sort of thing Bravo might send an entire production team racing toward. All the ingredients for drama are there, which seems like enough to hold viewers' attention. Rooting for wealthy vacationers to suffer is a favorite American pastime. But it feels as if there's something more driving the virality of this ship and the online world's uncanny intrusion into its material space. You might imagine a cruise as a place to relax and escape the real world, but it's also a carefully controlled luxury environment designed to be constantly offering you memorable little experiences of delight. In other words, exactly the kind of soothing, aesthetic joys that influencers post on TikTok. The digital world's obsessive interest just puts the vessel in a more aggressive version of the same surreal situation it was in to begin with, the situation so much of the world seems pointed toward. Everything here is just content. Everything that happens must be engineered for consumption, must pop and amaze. From sea-gazing in a solarium high above the ocean to dancing at the silent disco. As for the humans within those scenes, they too must always be on. Some of the people caught in Sebastian's crosshairs must be looking at an annoying bargain. Either you find a way to be telegenic content at all times, or you spend the next 8 months dodging other people's cameras lest you accidentally become the ship's main character for the day. Still, for the life of me, I cannot yet find anything actually happening on the Serenade of the Seas. One passenger, a conventionally attractive young blonde woman with more than 224,000 TikTok followers, posts day in the life videos. They're as banal and familiar as you could ever expect on a cruise. She plays pickleball. She pours sugar-free Smucker's breakfast syrup over oatmeal. Her pink sweater matches her pink water bottle, which matches her pink smoothie. A vast online audience is eager to turn such passengers into characters in an improvised reality show. But the havoc Sebastian hoped to create for them, or who knows, to cause, is nowhere to be seen. So far, his biggest complaints are about noise and lighting. How surprised can anyone be? Nothing exciting is supposed to happen on a cruise. This is presumably why seniors, especially American seniors, are so partial to them. And yet, hashtag cruise talk has nearly 3 billion views. Cruises may be deliberately undramatic, but there are things about them that we can't seem to look away from. The eye-popping engineering. The ship's so enormous it boggles the mind that they even float. All those ghastly, pearly white faces. Or the odd sociality. The rise of theme cruises dedicated to topics like Game of Thrones or Taylor Swift or knitting turns the ship into giant convention centers plopped into the ocean where thousands of like-minded people stagger from one activity to the next. The appeal of the cruise is that you, the consumer, get to exist in this suspended space that's been built almost entirely for your ease and enjoyment, for you to see and experience. But in an everything is content world, this arrangement can be unexpectedly reversed. Suddenly, your presence on a cruise may be the thing that others want to experience. Our mode of perception, our way of being in the world, fundamentally changes when this happens. When we are, willingly or not, sucked into the endless blob of content, watched or wondered about or speculated on by millions. As I binged on Serenade of the Seas TikToks, I eventually lost track of whether the videos I was watching were even made by people on the ship. I couldn't tell the average passenger apart from the working influencer, could not guess whether a given video was a result of incredible social media spin by Royal Caribbean, or someone happily doing the company's PR for them. At various points, I couldn't tell who was vying for my attention and who was merely subject to it. I was floating on the content blob, pulled whichever direction the algorithmic currents took me, and it didn't especially matter where I wound up, because everything looked, well, like content. People talked fast, looked good on camera, seemed funny and charming. All the pinks matched the other pinks, bursts of manufactured drama occurred at reassuring intervals, and nothing at all of any consequence happened. At least not yet. There was a time decades ago when passengers were given lists of the others cruising with them, complete with names and hometowns. This was meant to facilitate connections among the complete strangers who would be trapped together at sea with few people to talk to besides one another. That feels unthinkable today. But our desire for recognition and connection persists, and it bubbles up through our thicket of screens in the strangest ways. Mark Sebastian was eating breakfast alone until a couple recognized him and invited him to their table. He didn't film their conversation. Zachary Siegel is a journalist and researcher living in Chicago. His work focuses on public health, mental health, and the criminal legal system. I'll end with Judge John Hodgman on smartwatches in the bedroom. Katie writes, I am seeking an order to prohibit my husband from wearing his smartwatch during adult activities. I find it just as egregious as wearing one with formal wear. My husband thinks there's no situation where a smartwatch isn't appropriate. And the judge writes, I don't know what state dinner or royal wedding you might be attending soon, but I'm confident the only one noticing your husband's smartwatch will be you. Most people, especially at literal fancy pants events, are thinking about themselves and their own dork husbands. You have more standing in the bedroom, however. Whatever you get up to there, both parties have to be into it. And his compulsion to what? Get his steps in? Seems like a real mood killer. Unless the Times breaking news notifications are your kink, you deserve his full attention, as well as freedom from GPS tracking and the risk of unintended speech to sexting. I'll actually end with the ethicist. Ancestry tests produced shocking results. Should I tell my family? The magazine's ethicist columnist on the burden that comes with obtaining genealogical information. And the writer writes, my cousin recently told me that he would never sign up on the 23andMe or Ancestry site because that's how suckers find out they're adopted. Maybe I should have listened to him. Last June, my stepfather and I visited Norway to meet paternal relatives I've heard about and spoken with but never met. It was the most amazing trip I've taken in my life. These relatives were so kind and loving. We hit it off like we'd known each other forever. They showed me where my great-grandfather grew up and detailed my family history all over the country. During the trip, I made plans to return. I also started taking Norwegian lessons. But when I did analysis from both 23andMe and Ancestry, my ancestry composition didn't align with what I'd expected. It turned out that my paternal aunt is actually my half-aunt. My dad's dad likely isn't my biological grandpa. And I'm likely not related to my family in Norway at all. Now I'm feeling like the imposter syndrome. Feels dishonest to go back next year and not divulge my findings. What are my ethical obligations to a family I might not be related to at all? On the one hand, a significant part of me feels I should reveal this information. I've asked several members of my close family, and they all disagree. They're of the opinion I was raised in this family, I'm part of this family, and that nothing good will come from me disclosing this news. I can't shake the feeling that I have an obligation to tell them the truth if I do the trip next year. What do you think? And the ethicist writes, that significant part of you has it right. This information is obviously relevant to your relationship with these people, and it would indeed be a betrayal of trust not to share it. You may have some sorting through to do yourself. You found that your paternal grandmother, evidently, didn't conceive your father with the man you thought was your biological grandfather, a result of an extramarital affair, maybe, or maybe the child of a previous relationship, or of an adoption that wasn't widely shared in the family, or even a donor-assisted conception. So people you're connected to through just your paternal grandfather, are there any on this side of the Atlantic? Probably aren't blood relations. I do hope that you and the Norwegians continue to get to know each other, even if your node of connection isn't biological. Still, feelings about these things are complicated. The main thing is to proceed with honesty and own up to the fact that, to the best of your knowledge, no significant part of you is Norwegian. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.